She came to rest on a snowbank at the side of a highway. A teenage girl who could have been anyone's daughter. Her journey had taken her places no young girl should ever know. But finally, it had brought her home to a small Pennsylvania town she'd never seen before. If only she'd survived, she would finally have known there were people who cared.
She appeared on the highway in the spring, a young woman, her life cut short, her past and her identity a mystery. Only by finding out who she was could we ever hope to find her killer. I'm Jim Kallstrom, former head of the FBI's New York office. The highway gave the killer a quick and easy escape route, but the trail the FBI used to pursue him was twisted and long. We hoped it wouldn't be a dead end.
March 24th, 1993, Bellefonte, Pennsylvania. A late snowstorm had held spring at arm's length. On his way to work, a motorist drove down a quiet, snow-lined roadway. But something on the roadside caught his attention. What he saw was unthinkable in this peaceful valley. Pennsylvania State Police were immediately called in. A young woman lay dead on a snowbank near the junction of two major interstates. The county coroner determined the girl had died before she was dumped there. She was wearing only socks, panties, and a sweater. And she was young, high school or college age. But perhaps most disturbing, there was a rope knotted around her neck. And her hands were also bound. District Attorney Ray Grecar was at the scene, appalled by what he saw.
What struck me is that someone had not only murdered this young woman, but treated her with such disrespect. The way her body was found haphazardly askew on this pile of snow suggested that she had been just thrown out as if she were nothing more than a piece of refuse along the side of the road. It's something that makes you angry when you see it.
Her body was taken away for an autopsy. Soon word of the crime began to spread in this close-knit town of 7,000. It was the first homicide in Bellefonte in 13 years. Like District Attorney Grecar, the townspeople were shocked and outraged. FBI Special Agent Randy Kohick was among them. He was drawn to the case well before the FBI was officially involved.
That whole area up there is known as Happy Valley. It's a nice place to raise your kids. I lived there for 12 years. The crimes like this just don't happen there. And needless to say, to have a young girl's body dumped in your community is a heinous thing. They were extremely upset, and even more so, they wondered whether or not perhaps the murderer might live in the community.
Detectives searched for anything that might help identify the girl. They found no purse or wallet, and little else.
And I remember commenting to Trooper Madden that morning that he would be very, very fortunate indeed if he was ever able to even identify this young woman, let alone figure out who murdered her.
Trooper Madden of the Pennsylvania State Police would be lead investigator.
There was a slight indentation into the snow, about 6 inches, where the body itself looked like it had been dumped off of some type of object, be it a truck or vehicle, into the berm of the snow.
Madden surmised the vehicle had been a truck with a cab fairly high off the ground. Tire tracks nearby would prove him right. They were made by dual wheels, probably the rear wheels of a tractor-trailer cab. An evidence technician made plaster casts of the tracks to be sent to the Pennsylvania State Police Lab. Examiners there would attempt to identify the brand and check for anything unusual about them. Then, if a suspect were found and his tires matched the tracks, the casts could help link him to the scene of the crime. Troopers fanned out to find clues. They searched both nearby fields and local Penn State University, but found nothing useful. The body was taken to Lehigh Hospital in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. There, coroner Dr. Mahalakis would perform the autopsy, as Trooper Madden observed. The doctor determined the cause of death to be strangulation. There were no gunshot or stab wounds. The body's core temperature revealed the young woman had been dead less than 12 hours when her body was discovered. It seemed she had died some time before she was dumped on the roadside, as the coroner at the scene had guessed. Other tests indicated she had had sex before she died.
Whether she was raped or had consensual sex at the time was not known. However, based on the circumstances, we believed at the time that a rape may have occurred.
Dr. Mahalakis carefully removed the rope from around the girl's neck.
Wait a minute, right here, Doc, there's a piece of hair, this black hair.
Under the knot was a single dark hair. It didn't belong to this blonde girl. But was it the killer's? The hair would be sent to the FBI Forensics Lab in Washington, D.C., along with the knots for analysis. The type of knots could be important. They might help the FBI develop a profile of the killer. But the best clue came from the girl's left hand. There appeared to be something written on the palm.
She had some faint numbers written on the palm of her left hand. They had been written on possibly in ink. And they'd been on there for some time as they had faded, and they were barely legible. It was thought by both Bill and myself that possibly this could be the lead we were looking for that could possibly lead us to her identity.
Numbers,
the writing
letters.
Was indecipherable, though it looked like it might be numbers.
That's pretty faint. Can you get that?
Agent Kohig suggested experts at the FBI lab could make them clear enough to read.
It was thought that perhaps we could have these enhanced by the FBI lab in Washington, D.C., so the skin was removed from her left hand and it was forwarded to the FBI lab.
The girl's fingerprints would be run through a national database of missing persons. But the results would prove disheartening.
Checks were made with her fingerprints through the AFIS system, which is a national system of checking fingerprints. They came back negative. Checks were also made using descriptors of the body and characteristics of the body, and that also came back negative. So we had no record of a person missing that matched this person we discovered.
Then x-rays were taken by a forensic dentist. They could be crucial in identifying the woman. If a tentative ID were made and these x-rays matched those taken when the woman was alive, they'd confirm her identity. But first, she'd need to be visually identified by someone who knew her in life, which would be difficult after a full autopsy. Closing facial incisions made for the dental x-rays and masking contusions would take hours of painstaking work. To restore her to the way she looked in life would require the artistry of a skilled mortician. Stephen Mondock was just the man for the job.
When we received her body, she'd been through quite an ordeal. You know, we had to put a little bit of makeup on her. We had to get her hair done. We dressed her. We made her look as lifelike as possible at that point. We then proceeded to take photographs that were eventually placed in the newspaper.
Those photographs depicted her as more lifelike than she had looked when first found. But Mondock gave her more than a face. He gave her a name.
When the coroner brought her in, he said, "We have a Jane Doe for you." And I said, "Carrie," I said, "you know, I don't like calling people Jane Doe." I said, "It seems so impersonal." He says, "Well, what are we going to call her?" And I said, "Well, she was found in Spring Township, right?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Why don't we call her Spring?" And I said, "Well, she was found in the dawn of the morning, so why don't we call her Spring Dawn?"
Mondock's caring work gave investigators exactly what they needed. They showed photos of the girl to dozens of truckers at local truck stops, restaurants, and gas stations. Some offered the names of people the girl resembled. Her young face struck a chord of recognition in many who saw it. Notices in local papers and on flyers also generated leads.
The outpouring of calls to the state police at the time was plentiful, and we had to sift through every lead to try to determine if this person was a local person.
But none of the leads would pan out. Then, in late April, about a month after the body was found, the FBI lab called Trooper Madden. Their analysis showed the writing on the girl's left palm was a phone number with a Florida area code. Madden found the number had been disconnected, and he began to wonder if the area code itself was wrong.
But it didn't seem right. It didn't seem to fit this particular case. In looking at this person, there was no tan. It seemed as if she came from a winterized area, somewhat similar to where we were. However, we did not know where.
Madden's best guess was that she came from west or north of Pennsylvania, probably within a 12-hour drive from where the body was found. Madden also realized that there were two phone numbers written on the girl's hand, not just one. So he noted all the cities within the 12-hour radius that had both the exchanges she'd written down. Madden and Kohick would send the numbers along with photos and descriptions of the young woman to sheriffs and state police in those areas. Perhaps the information would trigger some leads. As they worked the case, the people of Bellefonte followed each new development, offering help and support.
There was a genuine showing of affection for this person and concern. I guess you could say she was posthumously adopted by the community of Bellefonte. And even though we were very quickly able to ascertain that she was not a local resident, there was still a very strong sense of she is someone that we cared about.
As spring bloomed for Bellefonte, the girl remained in people's thoughts. Her story touched everyone, especially Madden and Kohick. These colleagues and longtime friends could not stop thinking about her tragic death and trying to solve the case even after hours.
At the time I was assigned to this case, I had a 17-year-old daughter, and Detective Madden had two teenage daughters. So I think for the both of us, we took a very strong personal interest in the case. As a matter of fact, it pretty much took up all of our time during our working hours, and we would often find ourselves talking to each other at night on the phone at our residences.
Never was community support so strong is when Stephen Mondock began to prepare the body for burial.
I had florists call donating flowers. I had hairdressers calling to do her hair. I had people donating clothing. I had ministers willing to give their services. The vault company, the casket companies, the cemetery where she was to be buried was actually at the bottom of a beautiful mountain where there's wildflowers growing. We had the monument company had was willing to donate a stone to bury her. It was just amazing how much the town all came together in an effort to bury her.
More than a month after the body was found, it was time for a burial. Not only did the town want to bring closure to the tragedy, the body could not be preserved much longer. Still, Madden needed just a little more time.
The last thing that we wanted to do as a police agency was to lose the body. In other words, we did not want the body buried at that point in time without identification.
Just when the body could be kept no longer, a break in the case finally came. A sheriff's office in Maine received Madden's information packet on the girl.
See what you think.
Though he didn't recognize her face, he called one of the numbers written on the girl's hand. He had no idea who might answer the phone.
Yes, hello, this is Sheriff.
He reached Mark Rosenberg, a guidance counselor at a local school. Promising, given the girl's age.
I'm Detective Staples. Thanks so much for meeting me tonight.
A detective visited Rosenberg and his wife at their home.
I'd like to see if you can help me identify the woman in this.
When the detective showed the Rosenbergs a photo of the girl, they immediately recognized her.
Can you look at that for me, please?
And when they spoke her name, it was eerily familiar.
Dawn.
Dawn Marie Birnbaum. Steve Mondock's choice of the name Spring Dawn had been uncannily accurate.
And I was shocked. I was amazed. It was just a strange, strange, strange coincidence. But it felt right. She was part of our community.
Mark Rosenberg was one of the last people Dawn talked to before she died.
It was the last time we spoke.
Investigators hoped he could lead them closer to her killer. After a search that stretched from Florida to Maine, investigators had learned the identity of a teenage girl found dead near a rural Pennsylvania interstate. As they spoke to Mark Rosenberg, a guidance counselor at the school she had attended, he said she'd called him just days before she died, from a payphone. He'd tried to help her, but it was already too late. The school she attended was mainly for at-risk teens, like Dawn herself. She'd had problems with authority figures ever since her parents' divorce. In Indiana, where her mother lived, she'd been through a dozen foster homes and run away almost as many times. But at this boarding school, she'd finally found someone she could trust, her counselor, Mr. Rosenberg.
As Mr. Rosenberg was talking to Dawn, the operator was interrupting, telling her to put more money in. Time was running out, and Mr. Rosenberg told Dawn to call him again so he would know she was safe. She said she would do that. He gave her his home telephone number, which obviously she then wrote on the palm of her hand. She said she'd call back, but in fact, she never did call again.
The school would send Dawn's dental records to Pennsylvania, where forensic dentists would match them to x-rays taken at the morgue. The result would be a positive ID and a turning point in the case.
The FBI entered the case officially under our kidnapping statute. Obviously, we had a girl who was found in central Pennsylvania laying in a snow pile, tied up, and who had previously been seen just a few days earlier in the state of Maine. So we have the interstate aspect.
Now, we are aware.
The investigation focused in Maine, where Dawn was last seen alive. Maine State Police officers interviewed Dawn's friends, including Heidi Hansen. Heidi told them Dawn had been planning to hitch a ride with a truck driver, as she'd done about a year before. On that occasion, Dawn and another friend, Mandy Gray, had run off with a trucker named John Hoffpower. They dropped off Mandy at her home in Georgia, then continued on. What had started as a ride became a relationship. As the weeks passed, they grew closer.
And the woman of my life, Dawn, she's been waiting weeks to see you.
Hoffpower took Dawn home to meet his grandmother. They continued to travel together, driving his routes. No one knew exactly where they'd gone or what they'd done, but Dawn spoke fondly of her time with Hoffpower. They'd enjoyed each other's company, and he had treated her well. It seemed one of the few happy times in her troubled life. Then, about a month after Dawn was last seen, the truck was pulled over by police in a random traffic stop. An officer demanded Dawn get out. She complied. When she gave him her license, it triggered a missing persons bulletin filed by her school. The officer told Dawn she'd have to come with him. When he tried to take her away from Hoffpower, she pleaded to stay, to no avail. Police would bring her back to school. Since then, her behavior had been good, and she was due to graduate in just a few months. But things were not as they seemed. Apparently, Hoffpower was still in love with her, and maybe she with him. Though she hadn't seen him since their trip, he had tried to visit her at school.
Listen, I'm sorry, you can't get in here.
But security guards had kept him from entering the grounds.
You got no clearance to come in here.
Not having heard from him in a while, Dawn now told friends she was going to look for Hoffpower and run away with him again.
Was brought back,
On the evening of Sunday, March 21st, 3 days before Dawn was found dead, she had snuck off from a movie theater. She told her friend Heidi she would hitchhike to the Dysart truck stop in Bangor, Maine, hoping to meet Hoffpower.
Get two agents down there ASAP and get me all the information.
Hoffpower now became a prime suspect, since Dawn was last seen headed to meet him. Agent Kohick attempted to track him down. Apparently, he lived in Mississippi. But Hoffpower proved elusive. The closest relative agents found was his grandmother, who lived in Emory, Mississippi. She welcomed them inside and told them she'd raised Hoffpower as her own son. He was devoted to her. No matter where he was, he called her almost every day. He had even brought Dawn home to meet her. Now, when agents told the woman of Dawn's violent death, she was devastated. Then, she shared with him her own tragic news. Last September, a half year before Dawn's murder, her grandson had stopped calling her. He'd also stopped working and taking care of his pets. He'd left his wallet in his house and disappeared. His grandmother believed he was dead, though his body was never found.
His car was found riddled with bullets, and there was some reason to think that he had gotten into some trouble with some very unsavory characters and had met a violent end.
Agents learned his car had been found in September 1992, a few miles from his Mississippi home, 7 months prior to Dawn's death. By a strange twist of fate, Hoffpower's disappearance had led to Dawn's death. If Hoffpower had arrived at Dysart's, Dawn would still be alive. Their star-crossed love affair had ended in a double tragedy. Now, with Hoffpower presumed dead, investigators' struggle to find Dawn's killer was almost back to square one. Investigators' most promising lead had gone cold. They again had no suspect in a chilling case. The death of a beautiful 17-year-old girl left dead on a rural Pennsylvania roadside. On a tip from Dawn's friend, Agent Kohick and Trooper Madden went to the Dysart truck stop in Bangor, Maine, where Dawn had said she was headed when she was last seen.
Oh yeah, I'm Detective Madden. I wonder if we could ask a few questions.
They showed Dawn's photograph to the cashier, who remembered seeing her on the telephone a few weeks earlier.
She was over there.
Surprisingly enough, even though 2 months had elapsed, agents discovered that people recalled seeing the young blonde girl there standing at the doorway asking truckers for rides as they walked through. She was recalled by several people at the truck stop. And I guess when you're a young teenage girl and you're out on the road like that, people take notice.
It seemed obvious this was where Dawn had made her last phone calls.
This cashier's desk, where a trucker would pay for fuel, was only about 15 feet from the bank of pay telephones, which Dawn had used to make calls back home and down to the school. So it was easy to visualize how an encounter would have occurred between Dawn and a trucker.
Agent Kohick secured a federal grand jury subpoena for the telephone record.
No problem? Yep, a lot of problems.
Going through them would be a painstaking task, but it was the most promising option in a case fast running out of leads.
Mandy, her girlfriend, right? Mandy Gray. Some of her other girlfriends?
The people Dawn had called might know where she had been going, or who she was going with.
You got it. ASAP.
The phone records confirmed Dawn's call to her guidance counselor, Mark Rosenberg, in Maine. They also revealed she'd phoned other friends. It seemed her last call was at 10 a.m. to Mandy Gray, the girl who'd traveled with Dawn and Hoffpower. A state trooper visited Mandy at her home in Georgia. Mandy confirmed Dawn had called her from the Dysart's truck stop. Dawn said she'd gotten a ride to Dysart's from a friendly trucker who'd given her money for food when he'd dropped her off. Mandy said her friend had been disappointed that she hadn't found Hoffpower there. She seemed to have no one else to turn to and nowhere to go. If she headed toward Indiana, where her mother lived, she feared authorities would be looking for her.
Based on the conversation she had had with her girlfriend in Georgia, Trooper Madden and I reasoned that she had obtained a ride with a truck driver from Dysart's truck stop. At that point, I decided it would be best if we attempted to identify who may have stopped there for gas over that several-day period. And so I had a federal grand jury subpoena issued for all the receipts from the truck stop for approximately a four-day period surrounding when Dawn was last seen there.
Meanwhile, Trooper Madden obtained receipts for the three truck stops closest to where Dawn's body was found in Pennsylvania. They hoped that whoever had given Dawn a ride had bought gas in both places. It was possible. The distance from Bangor to Bellefonte is just over 650 miles, but not probable. A big rig can easily travel 1,500 miles or more on a single filling. Undoubtedly, it was a long shot, but Kohick and Madden nonetheless began the painstaking task of scanning thousands of gas receipts.
Over approximately the next 4 weeks, I compiled the receipts from Maine and from Pennsylvania and ended up with two separate lists. After comparing one list against the other, I noticed there was only one match on the entire list of several thousand names.
The name was James Robert Cruz, Jr. Cruz had bought gas on the morning of March 22nd at Dysart's truck stop. Just as Dawn was talking on the telephone 15 feet away. 3 days later, he gassed up again in Milesburg, Pennsylvania, just a few hours before Dawn's body was found nearby.
So this was a big breakthrough for us. We have a guy who's in Bangor when Dawn is in Bangor, and in central Pennsylvania right about the time her body is found.
The receipt showed James Robert Cruz Jr. worked at an Ohio trucking company. In response to a call from Agent Cohen, his manager verified the credit card purchases.
Okay, I've got the records.
Cruz was driving truck 44 on a route consistent with the events of the crime.
Got the times, got the dates.
Agent Kohick and Trooper Madden now had a suspect in the killing of 17-year-old Dawn Marie Birnbaum.
Okay, that sounds good to me too. Exactly.
Investigators pursued their prime suspect, wanted for the murder of a 17-year-old high school girl whose body was dumped near a Pennsylvania interstate. The man was a trucker named James Robert Cruz Jr. His manager told the FBI he was a model employee at an Ohio trucking company.
This is the file that we're
but investigators found he had a dark past.
I had a criminal history check run in the next few minutes and was able to determine that he had a rather lengthy criminal record. Most importantly on that criminal record was the fact that he had been in the U.S. military, and while in the U.S. military, he had been convicted of attempted murder via strangulation and had served time in Fort Leavenworth for that conviction.
His military records gave investigators another key fact.
We found that his blood type was A positive, which fit him into the small portion of the population which would be a possible source of the seminal fluid found in Dawn.
It seemed investigators were closing in on their suspect.
There's only one thing left that we could do to further attempt to identify whether he might have been the individual responsible for this murder, and that was to make a determination as to what type of tires he had on his truck.
At Agent Kohick's request, an Ohio FBI agent inspected the tires on truck 44 while Cruz was on the road in another rig. The tires were XD1, Michelin, low profiles, a fairly unusual brand. At the Pennsylvania State Police Lab, an examiner attempted to match that brand to the tire cast made where Dawn's body was found. He compared the cast to detailed photographs in a tire reference guide. They matched. Another breakthrough in the case.
So we had a match on the tires, we had a match on the blood, we had the fuel slips. This, at this point, according to the United States Attorney's Office, was sufficient to put together a search warrant to search Jim's truck and to also perhaps take blood and hair samples from his body for DNA analysis.
When Cruz was again away in another rig, FBI evidence recovery technicians examined truck 44. But if Dawn had in fact been in this truck, it would have been at least 2 months ago. So investigators didn't expect to find much. The fact that the truck was exceptionally clean didn't make them any more optimistic.
The search took pretty much the entire day, and it was an exhaustive search. We were searching both the tractor and the trailer itself. There were over 300 pictures taken of the tractor trailer.
But nothing turned up. An evidence technician was about to declare the search complete when something caught the investigator's eye.
And I looked at the passenger door and noticed that at the bottom of the door there was a piece of carpeting. And upon closer examination of the carpeting, I noticed one single blonde head hair interwoven in the fibers of the carpet.
You see something?
It seemed amazing, but there it was. Bill, come here. As if Dawn had not been quite ready to give up yet.
What is it? It's like a blonde hair.
The hair would be sent to the FBI lab for analysis.
My thought it was a little bit too good to be true that this could be a hair from Dawn.
When do you expect them, Joe?
Now, investigators waited for Cruz to return from his run.
Mr. Cruz, James Cruz?
They told him they were looking for a runaway last seen at a truck stop in Bangor, Maine.
Do you mind if we use your office?
No, right there, right there.
Thanks, Joe.
They implied they were talking to many drivers.
Take a seat right here in the shed.
Yep. We know you had a lot.
They asked to see Cruz's logbook for his record of travels on the days in question.
Sure.
The logs are government mandated to keep truckers from driving too many hours at a time.
Kind of a history of where you've been.
Cruz admitted he'd falsified his logs.
Is it pretty accurate?
Well, you know, it's pretty
truckers close. Commonly alter them to stay within legal limits.
Pretty accurately where you've been.
But it seemed Cruz's logs had been selectively altered.
But the one thing we noticed was that the misrepresentations in the log seemed to occur just conveniently when the fuel was purchased in Pennsylvania, also when the fuel was purchased in Dysart's.
I'm sorry.
In response to questions, Cruz calmly described his route.
Yeah, pretty much.
But when asked if he fueled up between Bangor and Pennsylvania, he said he didn't have to. The 240 gallons his truck could carry was enough for the trip.
Is this your signature on this credit card statement?
I then suggested to him that I had a fuel slip indicating that he had in fact filled up his truck on Wednesday morning. He paused for a second and then advised that he did in fact recall doing that, and it was due to the fact that they gave free showers away at that particular truck stop in Milesburg. I asked him why he hadn't remembered it, and he said to me, well, I guess I just forgot.
Mr. Cruz, we have a, like a show picture.
Then they showed him a photo of Dawn.
We asked him if he had ever seen this girl before. At that point in time, he very calmly and casually stated no, he had never seen this girl. He didn't know her, nor had he ever met her before in his life.
They told him they had strong evidence linking him to the crime. Dawn's phone calls from Bangor that coincided with his stopover there.
You have any problem with that?
The match of his truck tires to the tire tracks at the scene. And the match of his blood type to the type found on the body. He calmly chalked it all up to coincidence.
At no point during the interview did any of his mannerisms indicate that he was at all nervous with my line of questioning. And as the night slowly went on, I think even Detective Madden agreed that he became less of a suspect for us, even though we had all this circumstantial evidence. He was just too calm and cooperative.
Do you have any problem with that?
Not at all.
Cruz remained friendly, even when investigators produced a warrant for blood and hair samples. They would later learn from FBI profilers that such an excessively calm response can be a sign of guilt. On September 6th, results of the blood and hair analysis proved them right. The samples from Cruz matched the hair and DNA the killer had left behind on Dawn's body. With that evidence in hand, agents obtained a federal arrest warrant for James Robert Cruz, Jr. The FBI and the Pennsylvania State Police had identified the man who had brutally raped and murdered a young woman. On September 8, 1993, with a federal arrest warrant, Agent Kohick and Trooper Madden arrested James Robert Cruz, Jr. when he returned from another trucking run. As they made the arrest, Cruz suddenly dropped his easygoing attitude.
One of the differences between the initial interview of Mr. Cruz and the arrest of Mr. Cruz was his demeanor. No longer was he the cool, calm, and collected person he had been during the initial interview that we had with him. Instead, Mr. Cruz appeared to be very sullen and was angry towards both Agent Kohick and myself.
Cruz's arrest was the reward for determined investigators committed to catching the killer of a girl who could have been anyone's daughter. Just 6 months earlier, investigators had only a body in the snow near an interstate with no ID. He was charged with first, second, and third degree murder, rape, kidnapping, and the federal charge of unlawful flight to avoid prosecution.
But I'd like to take a few minutes.
For Dawn, the nightmare started as an adventure. On Sunday, March 21st, she left her friend Heidi at a movie theater near their school in Poland Springs, Maine. Dawn headed for Bangor, where she hoped to meet John Hoffbauer. A friendly trucker gave her a ride. She and John had been separated for months, and she looked forward to seeing him. But he wasn't there. She could not have known he was missing and presumed dead. Instead, her life would intersect with that of a much more sinister man. James Robert Cruz, Jr.
No, I'm okay. I'm fine.
Dawn spent the day of March 22nd making calls at the Dysart truck stop in Bangor.
I was just calling to let you know I'm safe.
She telephoned friends, letting them know where she was and that she was safe.
Okay. I'll just tell everybody I'm okay.
She also talked to her school counselor, Mark Rosenberg, to say she'd run away, but was fine and promised to call him that evening.
Okay. Oh, hang on a second.
She wrote his numbers on her hand for safekeeping. When James Robert Cruz paid for his gas, he saw Dawn on the phone, just 15 feet from the cash register.
Okay. All right, well, we'll keep in touch, okay? All right. Bye.
Cruz signed the credit card receipt, billing the gas to his employer in Ohio.
Here we go.
Okay.
Cool, that dude.
Yeah.
Bye bye. Thank you.
Hey, mister. Where are you headed?
I'm heading downtown.
Do you think you might be stopping in Georgia? Can I get a ride?
Absolutely. Get in.
Thanks.
It didn't take much to convince him to give her a ride. She and Cruz would head south. Prosecutors reconstructed the events that had led to Dawn Birnbaum's death. She had no idea of the danger that lay ahead. The hours she spent with James Robert Cruz would be her last. While Dawn prepared to sleep for the night, Cruz was still awake, falsifying his logbook. Dawn would soon find herself a helpless captive, trapped by a cruel predator, with no escape. Late on March 23rd, Cruz raped and strangled her, probably in the sleeping compartment of his truck.
That's what it was. Mr. Cruz stopped.
that same night after buying gas in Pennsylvania. He disconnected his cab from his trailer at the travel point. He drove away, looking for a place to leave Dawn's body. Cruz drove through the backwoods of Pennsylvania, anxious to dump the lifeless girl. In the wee hours of March 24th, he pulled over to the side of the road. He pushed Dawn's body out of the truck and onto the side of a highway entrance ramp. Cruz almost certainly believed he'd never be caught.
That's what it was.
And if not for dedicated investigators, advanced forensics testing, and plain good luck, he might easily have gotten away with murder. District Attorney Ray Grecar served as prosecutor.
And one point that I wanted to emphasize to the jury was how long it took Dawn to die at the hands of James Cruz. The pathologist testified that from the moment the rope was knotted around her neck, it took 4 minutes for her to die.
Grecar's approach was effective. On June 14th, after 14 hours of deliberation, the jury found James Robert Cruz Jr. guilty of first-degree murder. The judge sentenced Cruz immediately to life in prison without parole. He is serving his time at the Greene County Maximum Security Prison in western Pennsylvania.
The legacy of this investigation, I would say, is the fact that at the beginning of the investigation, all we had was a young girl laying in a snow pile who had died a death no one should have to die. No identification on her for the most part, and a very strong concern among law enforcement agencies that she would not ever be identified, much less have the killer caught and convicted.
We have Cruz behind bars. We have to make
But it seemed Kohick and Madden may have performed an even greater service than they first realized.
Sequenced with what we've got.
At the time of the arrest, there was a lot of media interest in Cruz because in his own home state of Ohio, there had been a number of young women found along the highways and on ramps over the previous year or two, and who had been tied up as well and left along on ramps. A review of our VICAP database indicated over the previous 10 years there were approximately 600 young women that were found along the highways and who had died in a suspicious manner.
We were not able to conclusively state that Mr. Cruz was involved in any of these murders. What we do know is that after the arrest of Mr. Cruz, the murders that we were talking about in the state of Ohio ceased.
For Dawn Birnbaum, peace had finally come. The gentle people of Bellefonte will always remember her, and the killer who took her life and changed theirs forever. The dense and rugged Alaskan wilderness provided the perfect cover for a fierce and sadistic killer. He preyed on women, kidnapping them, raping them, torturing them. He hunted them like animals for his own twisted pleasure.
the 1970s and 80s, people went to Alaska looking for a fresh start, to reinvent themselves, or to disappear for a while. Some of those disappearances weren't by choice. I'm Jim Kallstrom, former head of the FBI's New York office. A serial killer's rampage was exposed when the bodies of young women began turning up in shallow graves that dotted the Alaskan wilderness. The killer was at home in the rugged terrain, but the hunt for him began 3,000 miles away, where FBI profilers mapped the criminal's mind.
She was a hopeful young model looking for her break. She accepted a job with a man who claimed to be a photographer, but turned out to be a merciless killer. She wasn't his first victim, or his last. From the 70s through the mid-80s, the wilderness of Alaska became a popular destination as people flowed north to construct the Alaskan pipeline. The population boomed. On August 13, 1982, two off-duty Anchorage police officers were hunting moose near the Kinnick River in a wilderness about 20 miles from Anchorage. As they made their way through the dense forest, they happened upon partially buried human remains. They left it undisturbed. The next day, crime scene technicians from the Alaska State Troopers arrived at the scene. Crimes out here fell under state jurisdiction. Besides clothing and an elastic bandage, troopers found a .223 caliber shell casing in the shallow grave.
Conveniently buried here in the sand.
Dental records identified the remains as 23-year-old Sherry Morrow, an exotic dancer reported missing a year earlier by her boyfriend. Troopers called him in to break the news. Her clothes matched the ones he reported her missing in, but her good luck charm, the gold arrowhead pendant she never took off, was gone. Morrow was probably murdered shortly after she disappeared, giving the killer more than a year to cover his tracks. Finding him would be next to impossible. In the year following the discovery of Sherry Morrow's body, more women began turning up. It's a sad truth that finding bodies in the Alaskan wilderness wasn't all that unusual. Two or three times a year, some novice hiker or hunter would get lost and succumb to the elements. But a growing number of bodies had a different story to tell. During new road construction on September 2nd, 1983, A crew unearthed human skeletal remains not far from where Sherry Morrow's body had been found 1 year earlier. The bones had obviously been here for some time, yet until recently this area of the Kinnick River was so remote that it could only be accessed by boat or light plane. The remains were identified as 17-year-old Paula Goulding, an out-of-work secretary who had moved to Alaska from Hawaii. She had been missing for 5 months. Like Sherry Morrow, she had taken a job as an exotic dancer to make ends meet. And like Sherry Morrow, a .223 caliber cartridge was found at the site. For Alaska State Trooper Wayne Van Clausen, the connection was frightening.
And that's about when everything started to become kind of scary for everybody, because the profile was the same. They were topless. dancers from the clubs downtown, but that was certainly when there was the belief that there was a serial murderer out there.
Two bodies had been found, but now troopers believed there were more. They began to revisit missing persons reports. Many of those reported missing were exotic dancers, but in Alaska, their disappearance was not unusual.
Missing persons was a relatively low priority. Statutorily, if you're an adult, you have a right to be missing. And there were a lot of instances where these girls would just jump on a plane and go away.
Between 1980 and 1983, 12 women had been reported missing. That was only a fraction of the unreported total. Troopers now wondered how many of the missing women were victims of the killer. That would be difficult to determine. The Alaska State Troopers sent the evidence from the Sherry Morrow and Paula Goulding crime scenes to the FBI's laboratory in Washington, D.C. for analysis. The FBI ran ballistics tests on both shell casings to see if they were shot from the same gun. State troopers hoped the results could provide them with strong evidence that the same person committed both murders. The lab results were conclusive. Both women were killed by the same high-powered rifle. There was little doubt. Alaska troopers were dealing with a serial killer. While they began their hunt for him in the wilderness, the Anchorage police were dealing with their own problems. Every city has its dark side, and Anchorage is no different. Except that in Alaska, the nights are longer and darker. In the 70s and 80s, Anchorage was a frontier town. Men came here to work hard, and women followed to ease their loneliness. Some women were lured to the strip clubs, hoping to earn a quick buck. Others, looking for more respectable opportunities, worked in the clubs until something better came up. For many, it never did. And in the city's streets roamed a stalker. He chose carefully. His victims were hardly missed. For in a city made up largely of strangers, it's difficult to be a missing person. Some of the women who disappeared from Anchorage turned up safely. Some didn't turn up at all. But disappearances weren't the only crimes being reported. On the early morning of June 13, 1983, Cindy Paulson, age 17, ran down an Anchorage highway. She was partially dressed and in handcuffs. She managed to flag down a passing truck. She was running for her life. The motorist dropped her off at her motel apartment. The desk clerk had called the Anchorage police.
Miss Paulson?
An officer removed her handcuffs and tried to calm her.
You all right? Here, let me get this.
Anchorage Police Officer Greg Baker recalls the incident.
We found her in handcuffs with very little clothes on. She was real credible. She was very scared. She was very frightened. And she told us her story.
Paulson, a prostitute, told Baker that she picked up a trick the night before. She described him as wiry, scruffy, about 6 feet tall, with glasses and a stutter. He was not the kind of person she thought of as threatening. But as soon as she stepped into his car, he handcuffed her and put a wood-handled revolver to her head. They drove to a respectable residential neighborhood. He pulled her into his house. The place was well kept and full of hunting trophies. He had a chain hanging from the ceiling of his den. He chained her up and stripped her. And there she was tortured and raped repeatedly for hours. Then he went to take a nap, leaving her there. But he wasn't through yet. He said he was going to take her to his cabin in the wilderness. He said if she tried to get anyone's attention, he'd kill her and them as well. He told her he already had his alibi worked out. His friends were willing to lie for him. No one would believe her story. They ended up at the airport. She could see him loading a weapon into a small aircraft. She also saw her chance for escape. Her one chance to save her life. The story sounded outrageous, but her genuine terror compelled Officer Baker to check it out.
I had a very street smart female, scared to death, with a story about being taken at gunpoint and held prisoner at a specific location that she described where it was, so she knew where it was. She described the interior of the location. She described a den, up to and including various animals were mounted on the wall.
En route to the hospital for an examination, Paulson insisted on stopping at the airport to show police the airplane she had seen earlier. She positively identified it.
While we were in there, we had a security guard stop us and describe the car the same way that Cindy described the car, and in fact gave us a license number. That license number confirmed the address, or the area at least, that Cindy had given us regarding where the house was.
Police went to the address to speak to the owner of the car. They arrived moments before he pulled up, driving the vehicle described by Cindy Paulson. So far, everything Paulson said had checked out. But the suspect had his own story to tell. According to the motor vehicle records, the car that Cindy Paulson was abducted in belonged to Robert Hansen, a baker in Anchorage. Hansen, who fit the description of the man Paulson described, calmly answered questions. He said he was at a friend's house from 5 p.m. to 11:30 p.m., repairing a seat for his airplane. Afterward, he went to the home of another friend and stayed until around 5:30 that morning. Then he went to the airport and installed the seat. Hansen gave police his consent to search his house. Again, his home was exactly as Paulson had described. That only proved she'd been in the house, not that Hansen had raped and tortured her there. They could find no evidence of that. They did notice a loose-fitting wall panel. Behind it, they found a collection of weapons, but that wasn't surprising. Hansen was an avid hunter. They did find a revolver, but it didn't match the one that Paulson described. The gun, the chain, and the blanket she was wrapped in were nowhere to be found. Hansen's car appeared equally clean. Anchorage police found nothing in his car that fit Paulson's story.
Those alibis were corroborated and verified, and Mr. Hansen was released after a consent search of his house.
Paulson, still shaken from her ordeal, was able to pick Hansen's picture out of a photo lineup. But when given the chance to take a lie detector test, she refused. her occupation gave her an inherent distrust of the police and gave police an inherent distrust of her. She felt she'd never be taken seriously. Soon after, she left town for a while to try to put the nightmare behind her. Anchorage authorities were willing to let it drop, too.
I found out because the alibis were corroborated and because they had a problem with Cindy Paulson appearing and disappearing, and, of course, her lifestyle left a lot to be desired, that the case had been suspended at the Anchorage Police Department.
Police had gathered no solid evidence linking her story to Robert Hansen. But for Officer Greg Baker, it wasn't over. He was one officer who believed Paulson's story and wouldn't let it go. The predator roaming the streets of Anchorage was still out there, free to claim more victims. Robert Hansen, the most likely suspect in the abduction and rape of Cindy Paulson, had been released for a lack of solid evidence. Officer Baker was still curious. Lately, the Anchorage police had been grappling with what seemed like more than their share of missing persons reports involving prostitutes like Paulson, or exotic dancers, or women out by themselves. Paulson's assertion that she was about to be put on a plane only reinforced his creeping suspicions about Hansen.
He had taken her to the airport where he was going to fly her out with the story that if she maintained her helpfulness that he'd bring her back and let her go. Well, Cindy was bright enough to know that she was on a one-way trip, and so was I. And so I kind of just put two and two together and figured that he was a very good suspect for the missing dancers.
Baker's supervisor had suspended the investigation into Robert Hansen, but Baker couldn't let it go. Cindy Paulson's nightmarish story had too much detail to not have some basis in truth. But no one except Baker would listen to her. He continued his investigation. On the surface, Baker found nothing in Hansen's record to arouse suspicion. He had moved to Anchorage from Iowa 16 years earlier and opened a bakery. It was a huge success. He had a wife and children, and except for his stutter, he fit in completely. When he wasn't in the kitchen, Hansen enjoyed flying his small airplane, a Super Cub Piper. Back on the ground, he took to the woods. He was a solid citizen. He just didn't fit the model of a serial killer. There were plenty of others drifting through Alaska more suited to that role. They didn't have businesses. They didn't have families. Hansen did. He had everything to lose. Frank Rothschild was a prosecutor involved in the Paulson case.
Bob the Baker. The troopers and the police used to go to his donut shop all the time. It was a very popular place to go. He had a bakery. People knew him. He was friendly. He was just a hard-working guy.
Unaware of Officer Greg Baker's local investigation in Anchorage, state troopers were still trying to find their serial killer. Bodies continued to be unearthed in the Alaskan wilderness. Troopers set up a task force to study the similarities between the missing women and the murder victims. They hoped to find a common thread that would lead to a suspect. Until authorities knew more, they did their best to educate dancers and prostitutes about playing safe. For the first time, police and prostitutes were on the same side. According to Rothschild, the goal was preservation.
Law enforcement were then and had been for a time advising young women who were working in some of these clubs and who were working the streets to be careful and to advise them there was a maniac out there who seemed to be abducting and killing people.
A little digging revealed that Hansen's criminal history was extensive. 12 years earlier, in 1971, He'd been arrested twice for kidnapping, rape, and assault with a deadly weapon. They were crimes that bore an eerie resemblance to what Cindy Paulson had endured. Baker couldn't bring this information to his supervisor. The Paulson case had been officially suspended, and Baker was bucking authority. That left him no alternative.
And at that time, I gathered up all the reports and background that I could find on Mr. Hansen and carried it over to the troopers.
When the troopers received the file from Officer Baker, they were optimistic. Paulson's testimony, along with Hansen's police record from Anchorage, made him a prime suspect in the state case. The troopers' investigation dovetailed with Baker's. They were both dealing with the same maniac. Robert Hansen was their best suspect.
I think everybody was looking at him real seriously because he made a good suspect when you looked into him. He had a pretty extensive criminal background, including some sexual assaults.
The only problem was the proof. Though Hansen was a violent sex offender, his record indicated nothing about being capable of homicide, nor was there any direct link from him to Sherry Morrow, Paula Goulding, and the other missing women. At this point, troopers didn't even have enough for a search warrant. They knew only that three women were dead and 12 were missing. Out there lurked a serial killer. Troopers needed to catch him before he killed again. They needed help.
We knew we had a mass murder on our hands. That was not something Alaska had any experience with. Somebody obviously knew that the FBI not only had experience with it, but had set out this unit that was designed specifically to try to assist in discovering who these people were.
To catch a killer in their own backyard, the troopers called on help from over 3,000 miles away. Only the FBI had the resources needed to get inside a killer's head. When the Alaska State Troopers determined they had a serial killer on their hands, they realized they didn't have the expertise to stop him. But they knew who did. Quantico, Virginia is home to the FBI's Investigative Support Unit. Here, agents attempt to predict behavioral patterns by analyzing a criminal's actions. Retired FBI agent John Douglas helped pioneer behavioral profiling and still works as a consultant. His profiles are based on 25 years interviewing convicted killers. They taught Douglas how to think like they do. He's learned that serial killers are acting out their fantasies of control and conquest. As Douglas slowly wins their trust, he takes them back to the scene of their crime.
You finally get them talking, they start giving you that 1,000-yard stare. They're back. They're back 10 years ago, 20 years ago, when they were perpetrating the crime. And they kind of lock into that 1,000-yard stare, and their memory is just so precise. And the fantasy is what keeps them going over and over and enables them to survive when they're incarcerated. So I got to tap into that. It takes time, but once I'm in there, I get tremendous information.
From these interviews, he distilled a checklist of traits and habits that serial killers share. They start young, with lesser crimes such as arson or cruelty to animals. Over the years, their violence builds. To every new case, profilers bring the knowledge of how killers evolve.
To understand the criminal, you must look at the crime. You just want to see if you can come up with an analysis based upon preliminary police reports, crime scene photographs, a profile of the victim, autopsy protocol, reviewing that, review the autopsy photographs, do an analysis of the overall crime, the risk level that the subject took, the victim risk level, analysis of the area, maybe the crime scene, maybe you have multiple crime scenes, and then based upon that, you attempt now to come up with a specific type of profile.
By examining every aspect of an unsolved crime, a profiler can determine specific characteristics of that killer, such as age, occupation, and physical characteristics. The troopers contacted the FBI to see if the Bureau could work up an analysis of the Anchorage killer. They hoped the profile would sharpen the investigation and bring overlooked clues to light. the troopers gave the FBI what they needed to build the behavioral profile. For a scrupulous, accurate profile, they required only facts from the troopers, no analysis or theories. Trooper Wayne Van Clausen didn't want to lose any time. The information he received from Officer Baker aroused his suspicions about Robert Hansen, but he needed more information. Criminal records were just beginning to be computerized, and he didn't have access to them all in Anchorage. While the profile was being developed, he went to Juneau to collect Hansen's records from the Superior and Supreme Court archives. In his fact-finding mission, Van Clausen researched every town that Hansen had ever lived in. He found reports on Robert Hansen dating back to 1961. He gathered all that he could carry, sent the rest by truck, then headed home. While he was in Juneau, the FBI had come through with a criminal profile of the serial killer. The fact that the killer was so prolific meant to Douglas that he could function unnoticed within the community. Someone who worked independently, most likely a business owner. The killer would be an avid outdoorsman, since the bodies were recovered in remote areas of wilderness. Since he preyed on prostitutes, Douglas concluded the killer had difficulty talking to women, had low self-esteem, and grew up feeling like an outcast. Based on killers with similar profiles, Douglas provided a specific characteristic to explain the cause of those feelings of inadequacy, a feature that bore an eerie resemblance to Robert Hansen.
The one that totally blew us all away, I think, is that when they said he's either going to be a stutterer or someone who has a lisp, a speech defect. How do you figure that? But that was one of the things that they suggested might show up.
The FBI profile pointed to Robert Hansen, but the depths of Douglas's insight were about to be known. Upon Van Clausen's return, troopers studied the files. The records showed that Hansen had spent 3 years in a reformatory for setting fire to his old high school's bus garage. Based on their work with previous killers, the FBI profilers said the killer would have a history of arson.
You have a boyfriend?
Yes, actually, I do.
Yeah, because
the profile painted the killer as a social misfit. Hansen's court-ordered psychiatric reports from his days at the reformatory bore this out.
I'm really busy right now, you know.
I don't mean anything like.
His stutter was a social barrier that undermined his self-confidence. Whenever he tried to assert himself, he'd be slapped down.
I have a lot of work to do, or I'm going to call security on you.
He never forgot the sting. The profile said the killer would learn to function as a normal member of society while his perversions festered within. His record showed that in his 30s, Hansen began working at a bakery. He would brag to co-workers about his kleptomania and the sense of power it gave him. He also bragged about his love of hunting. He took great pleasure in exerting power over his prey, stalking it, then wounding it. And he became good at the kill, winning prestigious awards. In 1967, he moved to Alaska to start a new life and for better hunting. 3 years after moving there, his record showed he was arrested for the attempted rape of a young receptionist at gunpoint. He pleaded no contest to assault with a deadly weapon. A little more than a month later, he was indicted for the attempted assault of an 18-year-old woman he'd followed home.
As soon as the man got to Alaska, he was involved in theft cases, he was involved in abductions, he had psychiatric evaluations showing him to be really unstable and having all kinds of weird sexual fantasies and the rest.
True to the profile, Hansen seemed a respectable citizen, so the courts were lenient. In one case, he claimed to have memory lapses and was given psychiatric treatment and 5 years in a work release program. He abducted one of his early victims outside a coffee shop, took her to a cabin in the wilderness, and raped her at gunpoint. She was 17 at the time.
He told me, of course, if I called the police, that he would hunt me down and kill me. He told me he was a fine, outstanding businessman. He had never mentioned at any point when during the rape time or before or after that he was married, but he said he's a fine, outstanding businessman and that I was just a kid and nobody would believe me.
And he was right. Everything the profiler said about the perpetrator of the serial killings fits suspect Robert Hansen, a truly dangerous man who was passing as a nondescript face in the crowd. While troopers zeroed in on Hansen, they spread out to search for more victims in the Knik River area, where three bodies had been found. They believed that the dancers who were still missing may have been buried close to the other gravesites. But troopers came up empty. The area was too large and remote to cover completely. Despite the compelling FBI profile and the past police records, troopers lacked anything tangible to link Hansen to the killings. His police records were too stale, the evidence too circumstantial to hold any weight in a court of law. Investigators hoped that Cindy Paulson could help. She was the only surviving victim to Hansen's current wave of violence. Perhaps she could remember something else from her ordeal. Paulson gave another statement. But this time, she was able to ID one of the guns Hansen had in his possession. Aside from Paulson, Hansen had not been implicated in a rape or abduction for more than 10 years. But in the hopes of strengthening their case and establishing a pattern of behavior, investigators searched for another of Hansen's victims from years earlier, whose experience matched Paulson's. Although this prior victim no longer lived in the area, troopers tracked her down and asked for her help.
I had gotten a call from Alaska asking if I would like to maybe help with a conviction for Mr. Hansen. They had explained to me that he had killed, to the best of their knowledge, 7 women. And they explained to me that the last woman had broken free.
She agreed to testify when the time came, but troopers still had a weak case. The troopers felt confident they were on the right track. They didn't have enough to prove that Hansen was a serial killer. According to Anchorage Police Officer Greg Baker, Hansen knew that authorities were onto something.
One morning I was driving by and I needed to get some donuts for the shift. Mr. Hansen was there and he had a window that he stood in and decorated cakes and cupcakes and cookies. And I remember watching him. He kept looking up at me and you could tell he was nervous. And he kept putting frosting on his thumb. And I liked that.
Although investigators had Hansen in their sights, they still lacked the evidence to connect him directly to the crimes. But because Hansen matched the profile so closely, Douglas flew to Alaska to review the case and to brief the troopers and prosecutor Frank Rothschild on how to proceed with the suspect. Douglas was confident that Hansen was their serial killer. The hunter was now the hunted.
So the mission was to provide a analysis for them. Does he have the capability to commit a crime like this? And the answer was yes. I believe this prostitute, and I believe he's capable of perpetrating these crimes.
Douglas's idea was to bring Hansen in for questioning while simultaneously searching his house. To obtain a warrant, investigators needed to list specific items they believed to be in the house. They knew to look for the gun that Cindy Paulson described, and the one that fired the bullets found in the graves of Sherry Morrow and Paula Goulding. That wasn't enough. They needed a home run. something that would prove Hansen's guilt in no uncertain terms. They asked Douglas if there was anything else to list in the warrant.
Yes, some of the research findings is we're dealing here with a serial killer. And serial killers, it starts off as fantasy. And one of the things to keep the fantasy going after the crime is because they're on the hunt nightly looking for victims, is they take some type of a memento. We call them either souvenirs or trophies. Something belonged to the victims.
Douglas helped prosecutors write the affidavit based on the likelihood of finding mementos mentioned in the profile.
Okay, anything else? I've got those two.
Anything from a piece of the victim's jewelry to a driver's license.
We don't have any.
But a behavioral profile had never been used as the basis of a search warrant in the United States before. Rothschild knew he'd need to back it up with more conventional information.
Obviously, the district attorney's office wanted this search warrant to be bulletproof. They wanted it to be absolutely, positively, without flaw, because they knew this was a big, big case. The last thing they wanted was to have something wrong with the search warrant and have all the evidence thrown out.
The affidavit swelled to 48 pages. The judge granted 8 search warrants for Hansen's property. Now, they just needed Hansen. They had learned his pattern, knew his schedule. On October 23rd, 1983, they went to pick him up at his bakery. But Hansen wasn't there. He'd gotten off to a late start, unwittingly keeping the troopers waiting 20 tense minutes. When asked to come in for questioning, he didn't resist. The interrogation room was ready for him. The goal was to keep him off balance, hoping to elicit a confession and avoid a lengthy legal case. Douglas helped the troopers design the interrogation room for the biggest psychological impact. Crime scene photos and related materials were strewn everywhere for Hansen to contemplate before his interview. At the appointed moment, the troopers arrived,
Hansen.
Mind game began.
Mr. Hansen?
The FBI coached Rothschild on how to play it.
Ask him questions in a way that would prompt more discussion. So that's game plan number one. Then obviously, we've got all of these cases that have been investigated. And to get him to talk specifically about those, he's trying to search us out. What do we know? So I could see his game plan was to kind of find out what we knew and play off of that. And my game plan, of course, is to find out what he knew.
While Rothschild tried to get Hansen to open up and confess, troopers served the search warrants. Hansen's wife was home. The troopers were extra cautious, videotaping the entire procedure. What they were looking for could be anywhere, even in plain sight. Hansen knew the troopers had access to his police and psychological records. He didn't tell authorities anything they didn't already know. He spoke of his painful upbringing, his strict family, his anger. He admitted to picking up dancers and prostitutes in the early 70s and how enraged he became when they tried to raise their prices. But he denied threatening any of them. He admitted nothing. While Hansen told his story and his house was being turned inside out, other troopers headed to his bakery and to the airport to search his plane. Both were clean. The house became the focal point of the investigation. A careful search of the upstairs bedroom finally yielded a curious and eerie discovery. An aerial map of the region, peppered with 37 X's. They seemed to be clustered mainly around the area where bodies had been found. But there were dozens more marks than bodies, at least so far. The searchers continued up to the attic. Under insulation, the troopers found weapons. Among the items found were a .223 Ruger Mini 14 rifle, like the one used to kill Sherry Morrow and Paula Goulding, and a wood-handled revolver resembling the one described by Cindy Paulson.
Yeah.
The search team let Van Claussen know the good news.
Sounds good. These women look familiar?
The net was closing on Hansen, and he knew it. But he wasn't ready to talk just yet.
Take another look.
The interview dragged on for hours. It didn't seem like a confession was likely.
I haven't never seen it.
While troopers collected the evidence, the case unwound even further. Hansen's friend and neighbor stopped by, curious about the activity. She was stunned by the news, then made a confession that demolished the last of Hansen's story. She told troopers that her husband provided Hansen with his alibi on the night of Cindy Paulson's abduction. He'd lied to protect his friend, not realizing how serious Hansen's charges were. The husband later called police and retracted his statement. Hansen's alibi evaporated. As the search continued, the troopers found the most incriminating evidence so far. Evidence that Douglas knew had to be there somewhere. They found Sherry Morrow's necklace and other personal property belonging to the dead or missing women. They had found Hansen's stash of trophies.
Yeah, this is Baker here.
Investigators called the station. Though they had Hansen where they wanted him, still he wouldn't confess. But they had enough to lock him up on the Cindy Paulson case. Bail was set at $500,000. Investigators now had time to build their case against Hansen as a serial killer. They called the prior victim to see if she was still on board.
And at that time, they thought he had killed 11 women. And was I still interested in being a witness? They really felt that they may need me, because he hadn't confessed.
All right, what you got? Great.
3 points on the map found in his bedroom matched the locations of bodies recovered by the troopers. Another X marked the location of a body recovered by Seward police years earlier. The remaining X's presumably marked the graves of more victims, dozens of them.
Looking at the map obviously was pretty chilling, because we believed the map. The map was a body count, as far as we were concerned. The man had kept track. He didn't have newspaper clippings. He had the map.
When the troopers believed they had enough to convict Hansen on at least 4 murders, they confronted him and his lawyer with the evidence. Hansen couldn't refute it. He had no place left to hide. Finally, it was time to confess. Time for Hansen to cut a deal. Hansen said he would confess to the murders that could be proven, as long as the trial was given no publicity and that his family be left alone. He demanded that he be imprisoned outside of Alaska when the trial was over. In exchange for only 4 convictions, he agreed to show the troopers where more bodies were buried. Investigators called the prior victim to tell her the good news.
The third time they called back and said that he had confessed and they wouldn't need me. So I hung up the phone when we were done talking. I got my son off to school, got my husband out the door, and proceeded to fall apart. I started crying. I couldn't stop. I had no control over it. It controlled me. I could see each and every one of those women, how they died, probably hunted down like dogs, wounded, and then hunted more.
In his confession, Hansen described how he would take his victims into the woods and hunt them as prey. Over the dozen years that he lived in Alaska, he'd raped more than 30 women and developed many strategies for capturing them. Once he found a likely target, a solitary woman like Sherry Morrow, he would befriend her and arrange to meet her at a fast food place. If they were dancers or aspiring models, he'd offer to pay to photograph them. He'd arrive early and stay in his car. That way he'd be certain the woman arrived alone and had no one waiting for her in the parking lot. No witnesses. Then he'd go in and meet his new victim. One half of the handcuff was already fastened to the seat. Hansen boasted that snapping the other half onto his victim's wrist while reaching for his gun became like a reflex. Then he would take them home or to a remote motel to rape and torture them. Afterwards, he'd blindfold them and drive or fly them to the outskirts of town until he arrived at a secluded spot, his hunting ground. His habit was to toy with his prey before he made the kill. Hansen confessed that in the summer of 83, he devised what he called his summer plan. He sent his family away so he could bring his victims home. When he was done with them, he'd dispose of them in the wilderness. On February 27, 1984, Robert Hansen was convicted of murdering four women and sentenced to 461 years plus life with no chance of parole. After his sentencing, Hansen accompanied troopers into the field to find more of his victims, represented by X's on his map. A total of eight victims were found. Some places on the map went unexplored. Bears scavenged others, scattering the remains. Investigators will never know how many of the 37 X's represented one of Hansen's victims. According to John Douglas, the map might have depicted only a small part of his hunting grounds.
Killers like Hansen will come into contact with a lot of women, but fantasy is everything, and they may not like the way the person talks or the person dresses, the style, and so they'll make a decision. Well, this one will live. This one over here will die. I believe he was good for a lot more cases, and I still believe there was a chance that one of the reasons that caused him to go up to Alaska, he was running away from homicides back in the lower 48.
In the United States, an estimated 35 to 50 serial killers are active at any given time. Profiling has made them easier to spot and apprehend. Each time one is captured, investigators learn more about their twisted motivations, making it easier to catch the next one.